So, our final talk.
Wow.
They've gone quickly, haven't they? I'd wanted to last year in our discussion of self or not self. At the end, Satyanama had made the point that it would have been really good to have a sort of overview on Sangharakshita's views on that very topic. And I think Silavardhan and I felt the same about that. So this time we thought it would be good to have such an overview. So hence your suggestions had an effect. I've been reading the complete works by Bhante as they've come out. We have one of the editors here, Kalyana Prabhar, until recently was editing quite a lot. She's still involved in editing the complete works as they've come out. So far, 8 volumes have come out. You can tell I'm doing a plug for the complete works here. So since I've now admitted it, I might as well waive a copy of the beautiful uniform edition of Complete Works. This is actually volume one, but Kalyana Prabhar recognises it. Well, he's done the beautiful design, yeah. And so I feel slightly less disqualified than I used to talk about Sangharakshita's presentation of anything, because I've been reading through these volumes. And so I thought I'd have a go. You can tell I'm tentative about this, but I've discovered that I think I do have a kind of something to share, but when I say it's tentative, I think there might be a lot of room for additional points and clarifications and so on. But still, that's my aim. Let's start by looking at the first section in the readings that got sent out to you by email, and some of you may have picked up a printout here. It's a section called On Buddhist Philosophy as Such. This actually comes from the Complete Works Volume 19, page 353. So that doesn't very help you much. It's the second volume of a 2-volume set of from Bhante's seminars on Milarepa. They're quite extraordinary, these 2 volumes. This is 1,200 pages of based on 7 or 8 seminars on the songs of Milarepa, which haven't been published before. Sagarmati was there, probably Sadaloka was.
I was recording one of them.
That's it. So it's quite interesting to hear about, what they're like at the time. Reading them back, they're, I mean, 1,200 pages is a lot of, it's like a long road, if you see what I mean. But there's then occasionally you come across extraordinary passages. So I thought I'd start with this one because it communicates something important about Sangharakshita's way of understanding how to approach Buddhist philosophy. So he quotes from a translation of one of Milarepa's songs. "Before you have realized primordial truth, boast not of your sublime philosophy." So we're quoting this right out of context, just for the sake of discussion. This raises the question of the relationship between sublime philosophy, presumably Buddhist philosophy, and primordial truth. In the West, very often philosophy is speculative. One tries to arrive at the truth by means of the speculative intellect. But Buddhist philosophy starts from a very different place. The starting point is a spiritual experience. In fact, the Buddha's own spiritual experience. There was no such thing as Buddhist philosophy, no such thing as Buddhism until the Buddha gained enlightenment. But having become enlightened, whatever that might have meant, having attained that experience, having risen to that level of being, the Buddha then sought to enter into communication with others who were unenlightened, and in order to do so, he had to construct a sort of bridge. He had to be able to explain things to them. He had to get them to see things from the vantage point of enlightenment, at least intellectually. His effort to communicate the nature and content of his enlightenment experience in such a way that people could get some understanding of it intellectually and make that the basis of a practical approach to realizing it for themselves gave rise to what we call Buddhist philosophy. This is how it started. And of course, gradually it became more elaborate. But essentially, Buddhist philosophy is intended to communicate a spiritual experience in conceptual terms. It clarifies spiritual experience from the intellectual point of view to make that experience in some degree accessible or comprehensible for practical purposes. I thought I'd read that out because it sums up a really useful way to distinguish what we're doing in discussing Buddhist philosophy from any kind of contemporary approach to philosophy you might encounter reading a book or going to a university course on philosophy. It's not to judge one or the other, well, it's not to judge any Western philosophy in any negative way, but just to point out that Buddhist philosophy has a different starting point. Mm-hmm. And I suppose we've been seeing that, haven't we, as through these talks, that in order to even understand Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, one ends up, what I noticed hearing the readings last night that Sila Vardhan had chosen, especially the readings from the Sangdina Mochana Sutra, is that the discussion of the three natures, the Alaya and so on, it was those ideas that Buddhist philosophers took up and made them the complete basis of what they were doing. As Vasubandhu was doing in his discussing, in his 30 verses, for instance. So in a certain way, they were doing philosophy in a very different way to Western philosophers. They weren't coming up with original concepts. They were rather, what they thought they were doing was taking the word of the Buddha, as they understood it, and putting it into a systematic form, defending it against other points of view and so on. So that this conception of philosophy is very different from the modern Western one, in which we prize independent thought, original thinking. It strikes me, having read that by Bhante, though, that he was not unfamiliar with Western thinking, Western philosophy, and I thought it might be worth mentioning that if one reads The Rainbow Road, it soon becomes clear that Sangrajita familiarised himself with Western philosophy in his teens. You might remember he'd read Kant, The Critique of Pure Reason, three times. Pardon?
He said to me twice.
He said to you twice, and he said three times in The Rainbow Road. He followed that up by reading Schopenhauer, and he took selected Hegel, to India with him on the boat when he was conscripted. Imagine what his fellow soldiers thought of that. So he'd already read Plato, and so I thought here's where this is my a tentative thought I'd had that Sangresh just sort of absorbed those three thinkers, particularly Kant, Hegel, and Schopenhauer. In his teens, at that age, one's mind is still forming. So whatever he says about Buddhist philosophy, at the same time, he'd absorbed the creative thinking of the great Western philosophers, and they form part of the matrix of at least how he put things later on. So I thought I'd mention that as a sort of counterpoint point to what he says here about Buddhist philosophy. He's very familiar with certain Western philosophers. And actually, those great Western philosophers, who are all in fact idealists, a bit like Husserl, were themselves writing very much from the point of view of inspiration. You don't get any sense that they were writing to secure tenure at university and to meet the requirements of producing monographs. They're writing because they had been inspired by philosophy and had to write. They had to express their spiritual vision. So perhaps there's not such a great distinction. I was trying to get at that, I think, yesterday. Perhaps there's not such a great distinction between Buddhists and Western philosophy in this sense. Why would one try to write philosophy unless one had something to share of by way of a spiritual vision? So that was my starting thought. What I want to do now is kind of work up to looking at that second reading that I'd sent out and that you might have printed out. I think it's to put it into kind of context. So as far as I can tell, Sangharakshita's main account of early Buddhist of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, his writing about them, occurs in the Survey of Buddhism. So as you'd expect, isn't it, that in the Survey of Buddhism he includes an account of both Madhyamaka and Yogacara. He does so in a really fascinating, original way. This is in chapter 3 of the Survey of Buddhism, which I don't think many people read anymore. Anybody read it? Who's read it?
The Survey.
Pardon? No, chapter 3 of the Survey. So a few of us actually have read it. Yeah. I didn't know if anybody reads it anymore, if you see what I mean, because obviously chapter 1 gets studied on Transcendental Principle Retreat. But in some ways, I think even Sangharakshita himself has suggested that chapter 3 is out of date. You should perhaps also read Paul Williams' book on Mahayana Buddhism, he said.
Important to note that he said it's out of date on the basis of historical scholarship, not necessarily on the spiritual principles, though.
It's out of date. Perhaps out of date in respect.
Yeah, I don't think he thinks the survey is out of date in terms of its spiritual principles. It's out of date in some of the historical references and what is known about the development of the tradition.
Yeah.
It's a very important distinction to make when you say
that's
it's out
exactly
of date.
That's exactly what you said. He said for historical things, read Paul Williams, but doctrinally, it hasn't got anything to change.
Right, I was only talking about chapter 3 as well, just to make it clear.
But there are spiritual principles in there that are still very important and accurate.
Right, so... Yeah. So I thought I'd look at this kind of combination, if you see what I mean. This is just still background. When he discusses the rather original way he discusses the Yogacara and Madhyamaka is by schematizing the Mahayana schools in terms of the spiritual faculties, you might remember. So the spiritual faculties of wisdom and faith, meditation and energy. He leaves mindfulness, the spiritual faculty of mindfulness, without a school. But he links up Madhyamaka with wisdom and Yogacara with meditation. And by having done that, he makes the point that for the same reasons that one should simultaneously cultivate all the spiritual faculties and not concern oneself with the development of one only, the devotee is required to be a follower not of one school, but of all schools. So he recommends familiarising ourselves with all these Mahayana schools, so both Madhyamaka, Yogacara. It's a quote from the Survey of Buddhism, chapter 3. In his discussion of Nagarjuna, he compares the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the root verses on the middle way, with Kant. He says, for intrinsic value and historical importance, it is unsurpassed. Only the Copernican revolution, brought about in Western philosophy by Kant's Kritik der reinen Vernunft, Kritik of Pure Reason, that the one work with which it can to some extent be compared affords any parallel to the tremendous impact on all schools, both Brahminical and Buddhist, and its pivotal importance in the development of Indian thought. I mention that for two reasons. Firstly, what I've noticed looking at the survey of Buddhism on Nagarjuna is that Bhante had available to him only those translations and studies which were available up till 1957. There really weren't many. And it turns out that Western scholarship on Nagarjuna has gone through some stages. This is brought out very well by Jan Westerhoff in this book, Buddhist Philosophy in the Golden Age. So there was a first stage of Western reception of Nagarjuna, which focused on emphasising how Nagarjuna was rather like Kant. Yeah? He was rather Kantian in his approach. And that's to say, the now have I got this? I think that's right. I think that in the second stage was the Wittgenstein comparison, and then there's a third stage. Is that right?
Well, there's a logic stage.
It's a logic. That's it. I knew I missed something out. Is that the second stage? Isn't it?
That's it.
So the survey of stages by Westerhoff and some others is that Kant was first compared to, sorry, Nagarjuna was first to compare to Kant. Secondly, compared to logical positivists, and thirdly, compared with Wittgenstein and some postmodernists such as Rorty and Derrida. And Westerhoff makes the point that it's only now that Nagarjuna is starting to be understood on his own terms as a Buddhist philosopher. And it's not really a surprise, is it? His work is very difficult. So how does one connect with it? So the way to connect with it has been via apparently similar Western philosophers. So Bhante's whole exposure to Nagarjuna was at the time when the Kantian interpretation of Nagarjuna was in favour. And that figures in the work of Stubatsky, great Russian scholar, and T.R.V. Murthy, who wrote a book called The Central Conception of Buddhism. And this approach to Nagarjuna emphasised the idea that the Madhyamaka method showed up the limitations of reason. And by showing up the limitations of reason, they pointed to a trans-rational absolute behind what you can think about. So an absolute that you can't reach through logical thought, but which is where Buddhist practice is going to, is heading towards. Hence Sangharakshita's comparison with Kant, I think, here. Yeah, actually, Sangharakshita in the survey makes the point that the great dialectician Nagarjuna, having discovered that not merely some but all propositions passed upon analysis into their contradictories, had not only the boldness to declare that reason, being of an inherently self-contradictory nature, was incapable of arriving at the truth, but also the consistency to refrain from formulating any proposition of his own. Actually, Sangharakshita puts this across quite nicely. The problem with this approach to Nagarjuna that Sangharakshita knew about was that it's not that it's wrong, but actually there isn't any sign in Nagarjuna that he thought there was any translogical absolute. Mm-hmm. It's rather the opposite. The Madhyamakan dialectic takes apart metaphysical theses of all sorts without replacing them with anything. It's rather, it's part of a strategy to point to the problem with reifying thoughts, as it were. The end of reification, nishprapancha, that's the goal in Majjhimaka, you could say. They see that as being the point of the process. So the end of proliferation, the end of reifying thought, the as it were, the face-to-face encounter with emptiness, not as a concept, but as an experience, was where the dialectic is supposed to get you. So the reason I mention this is that it is actually not at all to draw any sort of criticism of what's happening in the survey of Buddhism, but rather to point to a development in Sangharakshita's thinking, because I don't think he rested at this version of Majjhimaka that you read about. It occurs to me that after 1957, Sangharakshita, living in Kalimpong, would have started to meet the Tibetan lamas who became his friends. And I'm not sure about this. I haven't read anywhere, but it occurs to me as a possibility. This is an argument from silence, which is not a good argument, because we haven't heard about it. But his friendship with Dharma Rinpoche may have been a source of information about the Tibetan experience of studying Majjhimaka. Dharma Rinpoche went through the Geshe training, the Gelug Geshe training, which was based on Tsongkhapa's interpretation of Prasangika Majjhimaka as the highest truth. So,
Could I
add something?
There's some information I could.
Yeah, please, yeah.
So, Auntie Dr. Nobar interviewed Lobsang Lalumpa, who was trying to write a chapter on an introduction to Tibetan Buddhism for some publication published by Kenneth Morgan. And his English was very bad. And he was going to Bandi, and Bandi was asking him questions. He was going back to Dada Rinpoche. And Dada Rinpoche was clarifying things, and then Dada Rinpoche would go back to Bhante and explain. So Bhante says, it must be in the sign of the golden wheel, but this was how he came to know a lot about Tibetan Buddhism through Dada Rinpoche, through working on this book, and he having to clarify concepts and things.
Thank you.
Like what you're suggesting happened.
Good. So what I've suggested might be might have something to it, that Sangharakshita might have encountered the Tibetan understanding of Majjhimaka through Dharma Rinpoche.
That was included in the introduction to Buddhism. Presumably that was included in this introduction to Buddhism that Lobsang Lumpa was trying to write.
Yeah, yeah.
He was writing in English, introduction to Tibetan Buddhism.
I would have thought Konza's work on the perfection of wisdom would have been another big influence.
Yeah. Which, some of which was already published before 57.
So he carried on developing it, so I think Bhante's understanding, and he turns more to the sutras, doesn't he? And he does his own seminars on Dharma Sutra and things. It might be going to
Yeah. Yeah. So, I suppose I'm suggesting that after the publication of the survey, it's quite likely that Sangharakshita's understanding of Madhyamaka and Yogacara would have deepened and matured, not just with the publication of more Western scholarship on these topics, but his encounter with Tibetan Buddhists who are familiar in their own tradition with these ideas. Cause we see something similar with is the way he discusses Yogacara in the Survey of Buddhism. As far as I know, the publications on Yogacara that were available in the 1950s were even less than the publications on Majjhimaka.
We didn't have any sutras.
Right, for instance, the sutras that we heard a bit from last night were not yet published.
Most of it is from the Chinese, which is a bit dodgy.
Right. But it's very striking in the survey that Sangrajita has a vivid sense of the Yogacara already. This really sticks out, I think. He writes, according to Nagarjuna, following the middle path means refusing to think of absolute reality, shunyata. So he uses this idea of absolute reality again, either in terms of existence or in terms of non-existence. But according to Maitreya Nata, the legendary author of early Yogacara works, this is an extreme view, and as such to be rejected. Reality is both existent and non-existent. It is existent inasmuch as it constitutes the real being of phenomena, but non-existent inasmuch as in it the subject-object relation inherent in mundane existence does not obtain. And he then writes, his views are summarised in a verse of admirable conciseness, which Tucci, the Italian scholar, renders thus. The unreal imagination exists. Duality does not exist in it, but emptiness exists in it, and it also, as in the unreal imagination, exists in this, in emptiness. Shall I say that again? The unreal imagination exists. Duality does not exist in it, but emptiness exists in it, and it, i.e. the unreal imagination, also exists in this, i.e. emptiness.
It's the first verse of the
Madhyantavibhaga. Madhyantavibhaga, that's it. So this was available. So besides enunciating, Sangrajita goes on to say, besides enunciating Maitreya Nata's own position, the verse attacks rival positions and answers possible objections. So the first verse, the unreal imagination exists, is practical. It affirms that unless ignorance, in the sense of some wrong assumption, is admitted, spiritual life can't really start off, in the sense of there can't be a progressive elimination of ignorance and attainment of enlightenment. There can't be a path unless that ignorance exists. But although the unreal imagination does exist, it exists devoid of the duality of subject and object. This relates, of course, to the paratantra nature, which is the actual nature upon which the imagined nature is projected. In other words, emptiness, which is the negation of the subject-object relation in
the actual terms used there, grasp or grasp, that's what I think we should get rid of subject and object. Sorry.
Actually, in this verse, that yes, it's implied, but it's not actually in this verse.
Yeah. The Sanskrit, it's in the Sanskrit as Grahaka and Grahya. I've read it. So
yeah. In the verse, it just says Dvayang Tatra Nadidyate, just the two. So the negation of the grasper and grasped relation exists in the unreal imagination, or constitutes its real nature. Spiritual life is possible only because the unreal imagination exists, but it would be equally impossible if only the unreal imagination existed. So Maitreya Nata posits shunyata as existing in the unreal imagination, where it functions as a support of meditation and makes possible the attainment of enlightenment. I've read that because it just seems to me like such a neat encapsulation of the whole of Yogacara, that it suggests that Sangrajita sort of found it very easy to understand this point of view, even at that point in the 1950s.
The The Shunya time is the Sala Tantra.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it wasn't something
No, no.
He does the same with Pure Land and Shinran.
Right.
In that chapter 3, with very little basis of information or scholarship, he kind of absolutely gets the spiritual principles.
Right.
Shinran's enunciation and why the Pure Land tradition developed.
Right,
it's,
right.
It's remarkable how he does it.
So, again, when one reads it in the light of modern studies, you know, based on a lot more exposure to the sutras and commentaries, it can look rather thin, but you're suggesting that the basic...
He gets the spiritual heart of it in a way that a lot of the scholarship doesn't always get.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's making a distinction between those two approaches, I think.
Yeah. So that was... I wanted to mention the survey just to draw out that this kind of point. And I think perhaps likewise... As I said with Madhyamaka, it could be that Sangrachita's knowledge of Yogacara could likewise have grown in the years after 1957. So I'm not aware of a Yogacara tradition that he would have encountered. Oh, actually, I'm going to come on to that. Yeah, that's it. So
he also studied Sangha.
Ah, there you go.
The Bodhisattva ordination with Dhamma Rinpoche, and as part of that, I understand he studied the Sangha with Dhamma Rinpoche. He studied the precepts, Bodhisattva. But that's embedded in a bigger work, isn't it?
Yeah. So that again. It that kind of confirms this idea that his friendship with Dorje Rinpoche and Yogi Chen, as we'll see, would have extended his exposure to these ideas in a sort of Buddhist context, not just through books as well. Yeah. So I'm going to skip on a bit now. As you might imagine, the books that have been published... Wisdom Beyond Words, and the book published as Mind in Buddhist Psychology, both contain some discussion. Well, the first, Wisdom Beyond Words, contains some discussion of Madhyamaka, and Mind in Buddhist Psychology.
Know Your Mind, it's called.
Oh, it is, isn't it? That's it. Know Your Mind, a seminar on Mind in Buddhist Psychology. That's it. That contains an introduction on the Yogacara background. To that Abhidharma. So it was interesting to look at those two and see what Bansi says there. Both of those seminars, original seminars, were apparently in 1976, 20 years later after the survey. But actually there's not a great deal of detail in either text. They're both rather focused firstly on Perfection of Wisdom, and in Know Your Mind, on the specific mental events discussed in that Tibetan book. Chandrakirti gets the only mention I can find in Sangrachita in Wisdom Beyond Words. Unfortunately, it's the quote. It's better to have a belief in the self as high as Mount Sumeru than to have a false view of Shunyata. Because if you are sick, medicine can cure you. But when the medicine has become poison, what hope do you have? It's rather important, isn't it? But unfortunately, it's not really Chandrakirti. It turns out that it's from Chandrakirti's quoting a sutra called the Kashyapa Parivarta. It's obviously a favourite of Chandrakirti. So it's not Chandrakirti's own words, as it were. It's Perfection of Wisdom text. I say unfortunately, in the sense that I'm very keen on Chandrakirti. And it would have been nice for Sangrach to discuss him. So what Sangharakshita says in Wisdom Beyond Words about Shunyata, I think is good here. He says, Shunyata is no kind of substance or thing, not even a metaphysical or transcendental thing. And we have to appreciate that language compels us to speak about it as though it was. In speaking about Shunyata, we have to do continual violence to language. And when we stop doing violence to language, when we start taking what we say about Shunyata literally, then we are no longer speaking about Shunyata. Oh, isn't that, that's so beautifully put. The basic point made by the Madhyamaka school and by the Mahayana generally is that Shunyata is not to be thought of in terms of existence or non-existence. Intellectually speaking, that statement is as far as we can go. We have to transcend it intuitively, as it were, with the eye of wisdom, and see what Shunyata is without seeing it as something that is. And at the same time, see what Shunyata is not without seeing it as something that is not. So it strikes me that this formulation of Shunyata takes this step beyond seeing Shunyata as an equivalent to an absolute, rather to seeing it as simply the negation of what you can talk about sensibly through reified thinking as embodied in language. That's probably all I need to say on that. Shouldn't say any more. In Know Your Mind, I'm quite interested in what Sangharakshita says about the Yogacara background there. He discusses exactly this point that Sagarmati drew out about how the Yogacarians take the mind-only sutras as definitive in meaning, as nitartha, and hence they start with the statements on mind-only as being the true teaching of the Buddha, whereas the Madhyamakans took those statements on mind-only as implicit in meaning, as neartha, not to be taken literally, as needing to be interpreted. And that's the fundamental difference in how they handled the scriptural material. So, and then he says, the Madhyamaka school, by contrast, explains away references to the Alaya Vijnana by saying that it's not to be understood explicitly. It is not to be taken in a strictly literal philosophical sense. Indeed, the Madhyamaka goes one step further than the Yogacara, saying that even mental events, or what we think of as mental events, are illusory, just logical fictions.
That's an extreme view.
So, on the other hand, texts which teach the universal emptiness of inherent existence are, for the follower of the Madhyamaka, to be taken literally, while the Yogacaran would have seen this, perhaps with good reason, as tantamount to nihilism. Now, I looked this up. There's a footnote in Know Your Mind at this point to the bit of Yeshe Gyaltsen's text, Mind of Buddhist Psychology, which Bhante is commenting on. And in that same, in Yeshe Gyaltsen's text, Yeshe Gyaltsen says, Nagarjuna and Aryadeva also divide the Buddha word into the explicit and explicit and implicit statements, but do not accept an Alaya Vijnana. They explain the sutras that deal with an Alaya Vijnana as having an implicit meaning and state that the world of reality is a set of logical fictions. So there's a subtle difference there between Yeshe Gyaltsen saying that the world of reality is a set of logical fictions, and what Sangharakshita says regarding the same teaching, that even mental events are illusory, just logical fictions, which, as Sagarmati says, is an extreme view. And what has struck me there is that Sangharakshita, he's admitted this, he has a, his approach, his way of studying things is to plunge into whatever he's studying and just to accept it all and not to subject it to any criticism as he reads, but rather later to reflect on it. And it struck me that here, in discussing Yogacara, sorry, in discussing the Yogacara critique, you could say, of Madhyamaka, or in characterising Madhyamaka from a Yogacara point of view, he puts it in such a way that Madhyamaka looks like an extreme view. It doesn't look, in some contrast to how he characterised Shunyata in the other seminar, where he characterised Madhyamaka in a more even-handed kind of way. I'm not criticising him. I'm just pointing out this seems to be the case.
The outlines of Mahayana Buddhism seminar, book by Suzuki.
Yeah.
And he read it. And on the seminar, people were saying, why are we studying this Pali? You're tearing them to bits every sentence. And he said, well, when he reads Kant, he's a Kantian. When he reads Hegel, he's an Hegelian.
Yeah.
He just sort of switches completely off his critical mind. Just accepts it all. Then, later on, he looks at it critically.
Could be, yeah. Thanks. So there's some more discussion of Madhyamaka in another seminar from 76 on Nagarjuna's Ratnamala, as you might imagine, which has been published as Living Wisely. But now let's turn to this second reading that I'd picked out. Now let's find it again. So this is from that same volume on Milarepa and the Art of Discipleship, volume 2, page 371-4. And this is from a seminar in 1978, so a couple of years later. And I mention that because, as far as I can tell, as far as I've been able to pick up, that was the last time I can see a discussion of Madhyamaka and Yogacara in Sangharakshita's writings. And this is where I'm probably going to get corrected. So 78, a long time ago, isn't it? And what he says there is particularly interesting, and that's what I'm not going to read through it all. I'm just going to draw out some points. So here, Sangharakshita isn't commenting either on, he's not commenting on, Milarepa's not a Madhyamakan or a Yogacharan. He's, pardon?
Kagyupa.
He's a Kagyupa. He's got a sort of, his philosophical commitment, if he's got one, is to some sort of Mahamudra account of reality, which it doesn't relate easily to either Madhyamaka or Yogacara. It's a further development within the Tibetan context of those ideas. So Bhante doesn't need to take sides here in relation to what he's commenting. But he needs to comment because Milarepa's just said to Rechungpa, he's just described the Dharma view to Rechungpa. He wants Rechungpa to get clear on his Dharma view. And he characterises, just briefly in verse, his own view. And then he goes on, this is the second paragraph, as he does in these seminars, he takes a certain reading from Milarepa as an excuse to talk about something else that is important for his listeners. He says, as to whether we have yet a view in this sense in our own Buddhist movement, I would say that to the extent that there is a view, it is probably, so far at least, the view of the Madhyamaka rather than that of the Yogacara. So let's just dwell with that a bit. So as to whether we have yet a view in our own sense in our own Buddhist movement, I would say that to the extent that there is a view, it's probably Madhyamaka rather than Yogacara. Now, I'm probably right in thinking that he says that he means what he thinks. Is that right? Yeah, isn't it wonderful? I suppose that what he's getting at is to the degree that Sangharakshita believes that there is a view that ought to be shared in the emergent Buddhist movement he's founded, he has provisionally thinks it ought to be Majjhimaka rather than Yogacara.
What date is this?
78.
Well, I guess he'd studied the Bodhicharya Avatara, the people as well. I don't think that was his first text he studied in a seminar, which is Majjhimaka, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And that was the first thing he gave a lot of emphasis to.
Yeah.
And published as the Endlessly Fascinating Craft seminar. And
oh, yeah,
was in quite a bit in that. Right. And then the seminar on the Manjibhusha Stuti Sagan, where he talks quite a lot about the void and about view and emptiness.
Yeah.
Appearance and emptiness.
Great. The Endlessly Fascinating Cries, not yet anywhere near out, I don't think, in the complete world. Oh, is that coming out in April?
It's by Bodhisattva Ideal.
Oh, right, excellent.
There's been a lot of discussions that have gone on for the weekend, and hardly any comment on the dashes.
Well, that's a shame. Let's see what.
Great. So, those seminars were before 1978. Is that right?
That was 1974.
Yeah. So earlier ones.
Yeah.
So, I'll keep going, and then this is the question. So, this is quite, as far as I can. Otherwise, you don't tend to. Sangharaj doesn't tend to express this kind of view about. Which is the view to be preferred, as it were, or to be favoured in some sense. So then he goes on to explain this point of view he's developed. The perfection of Wisdom Sutras and the Madhyamaka school, at least from a certain point of view, give expression to what, as far as we can see, is the ultimate view, that is, thought, concepts taken as far as they can possibly be taken. Even the Yogacara view, though very useful and very sublime, seems to be, to some extent, a falling away from that, almost a concession to relative truth. One could say that, although we don't make much of it, the view, and the view that Rupa is Shunyata, Shunyata is Rupa, is our view.
So that's why I asked you yesterday when you were to, where do we stand? I asked you if you meant individually or as a movement.
Yeah.
Because I knew Bhatti had said that.
Right. So where we stood in 1978,
exactly,
when I was 12, was that we preferred. Pardon? Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Let me finish this paragraph, and then we'll. So, in other words, putting it in plain, direct, down-to-earth terms, we stress the primacy of experience over thoughts. We stress the primacy of experience over thoughts, and to state that in the traditional conceptual Indian way is to state the Madhyamaka philosophy. And perhaps we can now unpack that in terms of what we've been studying over the last couple of days. The Madhyamaka philosophy doesn't have any doctrinal content apart from the two truths. There's nothing to believe. There's no thesis put forward about reality. There's rather the systematic destruction of your tendency to reify, to believe that your words and concepts point beyond themselves to anything that really exists, or in fact doesn't exist. So there's the philosophical attempt to encounter experience rather than thoughts about experience, and that philosophical approach is the one that Sangharaja believes is preferable. And when Sagarmati was going through the 30 verses, it's clear in a way that is offered a model of the mind. But in a sense, to accept a model of the mind is to accept a sense of set of thoughts about how the mind works. So no matter how good we think it is, it's a set of thoughts about how the mind works. And that, it seems to me that Sangharaja is highlighting the just drawing attention to that aspect of Yogacara.
And the three lakshanas is very, very different. Well, I'll give you an example. With that discussion with Bhante about Madhyamaka and Yogacara, and I said, but the problem with the two truths is that it can be misunderstood. And I said, and that's why the Yogacara is necessary,
yep,
to bring up the three lakshanas. I said, and so the Yogacara is superior to the Madhyamaka. And he said it was. This is only a few years ago. But he said, but he feels very at home with the Madhyamaka.
Right.
That's what he said. He said he agrees with the Yogacara, but he's very happy in the Madhyamaka. So he's talking about himself.
Well, I suppose that's what's interesting in this talk about we, isn't it? Is that what it reveals about, does it point to a personal preference, or does it point to some reason to suppose that these views might be more useful in the context of a sangha? And that's the question.
But in the seven papers, he sort of says we have to go back to the Buddha.
Right. Yeah. So the next paragraph is about Zen. But then the next paragraph, unless you apply, unless you apply Madhyamaka analysis to the Yogacara or to the very concept of oneness, you get into all sorts of difficulties. There's a Zen koan that asks, when you have reduced all things to the one mind, to what will you reduce the one mind? That represents, in a nutshell, the Madhyamaka critique of the Yogacara.
This is Paramahata stuff from China.
So, here we go, look, Sagamati. He then says, my friend and teacher, Mr. Chen, and I used to discuss this quite a lot, and it was Mr. Chen's view that the difference between the two schools was that the Madhyamaka reduced everything directly to Shunyata, whereas the Yogacara reduced everything to the one mind, and then reduced the one mind to Shunyata. So, as we learned yesterday, the Yogi Chen would have been familiar with the Chinese traditions of Yogacara, in which the innovation was to introduce an Amala Vijnana, a pure consciousness, which is regarded as the one mind here. When we look at Vasubandhu and other Indian Yogacarans, we don't in fact find that concept of the one mind. We find a more analytic kind of philosophy without such metaphysical commitments.
It also seems mentioned in the Langaratara Sutra. Like Vasubandhu and all that, they never even mention it. And that is a commentary on it. It's the Sangita Mocana Sutra, the Yogacara Sutra. This one is held in a highly suspected by Yogacarans. You know, it was Bodhidharma was meant to take it to China, it's very untrustworthy. It goes into the Bhagavad-gata and all the features of the notion of a self. You know, it's...
Which
sutra is speaking of? The Langaratara.
Yeah. So, I'm just going to carry on a bit now, because what he says next is it takes us back to a more affirmative attitude to Yogacara. Yogi Chen did not agree that the Yogacara represented an inferior or a lower truth. In his mind, it simply represented a different procedure. That seems quite plausible, and it still represents the Madhyamaka viewpoint as being the ultimate viewpoint, although Nagarjuna makes it very clear in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika that he does not propound any view. Bhante then discusses the possibility of the connection between Yogacara and Shamatha practice, although without making a strong point about that. And he's limiting his point a bit here about Madhyamaka. Pardon? Proviso. Yeah, there's a proviso. That's it. Thank you. Originally, the Majjhimaka's insights. So originally, the Majjhimaka's insights revealed themselves within the context of meditation. But eventually, the context disappeared, and they were left with the intellectual, conceptual formulations of the insights to play around with. And that produced a dry Majjhimaka dialectic. Now, I think this is important because it shows that even though Sangharakshita has expressed a preference for Majjhimaka, he doesn't think there's any benefit in a dry intellectual Majjhimaka. So he's not saying that's to be preferred over a rich meditative philosophy like Yogacara. But what he goes on to say at the end of that, at the end of the next paragraph, you might have noticed, he goes on to say a bit what he means, that he's met. So just to quote from the next paragraph near the bottom, you find among Tibetan Geshes very learned men who know their Madhyamaka philosophy inside out, with all the commentaries and sub-commentaries and so on, but who don't meditate and thus haven't developed the corresponding insight. So far as they are concerned, the Majjhimaka is just a school of philosophy. You're a Majjhimaka Vardin, just as in the West you might be an Aristotelian or a Hegelian or a Kantian. So I thought that was important to draw out the limitations. It's not an unqualified affirmation of Majjhimaka at all. He's pointing out that it also can become a dry, empty kind of system. I was mentioning yesterday that Majjhimaka became the official philosophy of the Gelug school in Tibetan Buddhism. And so all the Geshes learn Tsongkhapa's interpretation of Chandrakirti's interpretation of Nagarjuna. But as far as I understood it, the whole point is to develop a view that you then actualise in meditation. You know, you sort out your view in order to actualise it in meditation. If you don't actualise it, then it seems to be not very useful, does it? So Bhante's kind of reinforcing that point. And perhaps that... Yeah, so he concludes that section that I've copied to you. The last paragraph. In a way, the Yogacara approach of reducing everything to the one mind first is safer, because it ensures that you do actually get onto the path of meditation. Although in the end, the Yogacara became scholastic too. So he concludes by saying there's no school of philosophy, no view even, to which you can commit yourself with the certainty that it won't ever ossify into an academic system. But to sum up, it strikes me that the overall view here that we get, the overall understanding we get from Sangharakshita in 1978 is that the Madhyamaka account of ultimate reality is at least to be preferred, it's at least Sangharakshita's preference, and possibly to be preferred in the movement he's founded. But this doesn't particularly mean that Yogacara is problematic only if it's taken literally. And in fact, he seems to suggest that since it's connected with meditation, it can be particularly useful as a philosophy for exploring meditation. And actually, this view, I don't think Sangharakshita would have had access to the sort of... there's a lot of very good scholarship now on Madhyamaka and Yogacara. I read a book, it's this one here called Madhyamaka and Yogacara, Allies or Rivals, set of papers by, I mean, they're all Western academics, but they're all Buddhist, who knows, a lot of them are Buddhist practitioners as well, that's how it goes. And the strong picture you get from paper after paper, article after article there, is that the Madhyamaka and Yogacara shouldn't really be, they can't really be synthesised into a single system. But rather, even going back to Nagarjuna, he took on board mind-only points of view as means to an end. Yeah, and we saw that a bit in Chandrakirti yesterday, that he thinks there's a use in the idea of mind-only for undermining the belief in the ego. And so the Yogacara system, for instance, that we saw as developed in Vasubandhu, might be perfectly useful, practical philosophy for exploring meditation. And that's that point of view, which goes right back to Nagarjuna, basically, this view of mind-only Yogacara as a useful philosophy within the Madhyamaka view of ultimate truth. It's a position that Sangharaksha seems to have already reached in the 70s.
Mm. Didn't he say somewhere that philosophically the approach we've been Madhyamaka, just in terms of meditation and practice, we're more Yogacara?
Yeah.
Do you know where he says that?
No, but I have heard that.
Mm. I remember reading it, but I can't remember where now.
So I've just brought out what I've been able to read. So it would be great, wouldn't it, to sort of spot that kind of reference. Yeah. So, and just to... I had a kind of concluding set of thoughts, but there's not time for me to share them, I don't think. Do you want me to? Well, it's 5:05. I don't know. You might want a cup of tea. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. So here's my not quite finishing thought then. I was going to conclude this section on Bhante's thought by the thought that I haven't come across yet any shift in Sangharaksha's point of view on Madhyamaka and Yogacara since 1978. So I might be wrong, of course, because I'm not that familiar with his thinking, but it's not obvious. Does that make sense? And actually, nobody's disagreed yet. And in fact, Sadaloka's quote just backs up that position we came to.
Yeah, I don't know what year that was. But
no.
It could have been 1979.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Because last year, when we went to see Bhante, there were certain things in the Bhante Gorgeous studies out in the 79.
Yeah.
And I thought a lot of them because I couldn't disagree with them. I can't tell you, I'm not going to say what it was, but you did agree that because I said, well, this is the problem, Bhante. The fact is, you have changed your mind quite a bit since 1978.
You'd imagine
and
so.
I know that because I've talked to him a lot, and I get, you know. And I think it's the problem with bringing out this edition. The fact is, you've got Bhante's old views there. He even talked very kindly about the Tathagata Garbha. The last thing he said to me, he said, you can call it a heresy. You know, so... there is a kind of big difference between early Bhante and later Bhante in views. And I don't know how we can go about rectifying that.
Wouldn't he have addressed that if it was a big enough shift in his view? Wouldn't he have addressed that in his writings? Because he was still writing up until very recently.
Yeah, what he used to say was, "We'll leave that up to you."
Mm.
You know, because Bhante was very old. He felt he'd done enough.
Mm.
He'd set up this movement and everything like that and got us going. So that's enough.
Mm.
And he said, it's up for other people to sort out the little bits and pieces. Sort of thing. Yeah.
Therefore, why do we have to rectify that, as you said?
Well,
because that seems to be the most sufficient answer. If Bhante's saying, well, he's leaving it up to us, then you're at liberty to take where you like, as long as you remember that he did change his mind.
Yeah.
So I think that's fair enough.
If he says up to us that you can do that if you know Bhante inside out.
Mm.
You've got to really know somebody's thought, development thought. Of course, if you read the history of my going for refuge, you see a whole development in this understanding of going for refuge, which I think you gave a talk on in Essen that time, so I didn't
remember
the thinker. So we can develop Bhante, but let's first be immersed in Bhante and really know what he said, thought over a teaching period of how many years? 70 years. Yeah.
I wasn't so much thinking it in terms of developing Bhante. I was thinking it in terms of looking at him as kind of spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
You know, as long as one is aware that he had different views at different points in his life, it, in a sense, that doesn't matter. You know, you can still say, well, okay, he said this at this particular point for these reasons,
yeah.
And I think that's fair enough. You know, and that is fair enough.
Because also, Bhante, probably lots of people here know this. He'll say different things to different people at different
times
in the same year. Yeah. So he's saying something to that person or for a situation, and then he's produced.
Sure. A sub-absolute teaching, yeah.
So I better finish, because I think, you know, these kind of conversations will go on a little while, won't they? And so perhaps if I finish, then in the small group discussion, we can carry on with all that. I think there's a parallel between this. It's not quite closure, is it, of Bhante's views in the late 70s. It's but some kind of settling down into a certain sort of conclusion, which we aren't sure how much is anything like closure, because Bhante keeps saying other things. But I think there's a parallel. I last year, Vijay Devi produced this volume called This Is Not a Book, prior to our prior to our symposium on non-self last January, and reading that after the event was really an eye-opener, because it seemed to me very clear that up until the late 70s, Sangharakshita spelled out the not-self teaching, the anatman teaching, in traditional Buddhist terms. And then in the late 70s, he started doing something different. He stopped spelling out anatman in the classical traditional Buddhist way, and he started, his strategy changed to emphasizing not just the denial of a fixed self, but the ideal of the growth and development of the self. He took the next step. There's no fixed self, therefore what you are can change. There can be growth and development of the self. Regarding the self, the self as a linguistic fiction. Yeah, so you're what you think you are is a sort of fiction, but it can change and grow, and this ties up with the idea of true individuality, as it were. And what really struck me in this selection was that you can sort of see it was a lecture series in New Zealand in 1979 where he starts talking in this way, and after that he never returns to talking about anatman in these published works. Again, who knows, you know, it must be very difficult to gauge everything. And that struck me when I read it as a pretty interesting sign of how Sangharakshita's teaching shifted from one of presenting traditional Buddhist ideas and doctrines in a sort of traditional Buddhist way into pitching them to what he now saw as the needs of Western Buddhists. So denying a fixed self has got a very limited interest to Western Buddhists, who tend to be nihilist anyway, whereas emphasising the capacity to grow and develop did a lot more good. So I wondered if there was some similar sort of dynamic in relation to Madhyamaka and Yogacara, in as much as, you know, he kept on characterising these schools of Buddhist philosophy up until the late 1970s. And after that, as far as I can tell, he didn't particularly emphasise them much more in his public teaching. But it struck me that, likewise, there might be a way in which he shifted the teaching to ideas or approaches which were much more relevant to a Western audience. So it struck me that, firstly, his preference for the Madhyamaka view of the ultimate truth is reflected in his very consistent approach to emphasising not taking teachings literally. And therefore his emphasis on the role of imagination as the creative principle of life and thought. If you can begin to understand the role of imagination in how we think of ourselves, how we envisage the world, the possibilities of our changing, as it were, possibilities of a new Buddhist movement, there's no way you can literalise what you know to be the workings of imagination, whilst seeing that there's no other better, that, you know, that is the faculty which enables us to see things in a different way. That kind of negative capability, to use Keats's term, is our best guide, as it were, to the truth. It's groundless and self-originating, that's what I've written here. And it struck me, it's much closer to Blake than to a Madhyamaka kind of ideal of emptiness. And then secondly, it struck me that some of Sangharakshita's ideas might be regarded as somewhat provisional and unsystematic, of a sort of instrumental nature for the sake of the modern Western engagement with the Dharma as lived. And I suppose I had in mind the this is to come right up to date, the system, as it were, of five orders of conditionality, also known as the so-called five niyamas, which we could see that this system of five orders of conditionality is as sketching out, without really much detail, and without really any sort of serious attempt at justification, an epistemological framework for understanding the Dharma life within our modern context. So what I mean by an epistemological framework is that this system of five orders of conditionality incorporate an account of the laws of physics, biology and psychology, and then within the same system incorporate ethics in the form of karma and spiritual life in the form of the so-called Dharma Niyama. But what I think is interesting there is the possibility of thinking of that system as a set of fictions. Yeah, ultimately fictions that give meaning to our conventional lives, they work within the conventional truth systems of modern life. So they're not supposed to have a sort of ultimate grounding. There's no need to suppose that they can be justified in that way if we take them to be kind of fictions that get us to relate to our experience as enabling the possibility of practicing the Dharma.
Fiction's a bit too strong, you know, because you can't a fiction is something that doesn't exist. So you can't base your practice on something that doesn't exist.
Well, from the Madhyamaka point of view, to suppose any conventional truth is true, it corresponds to some state of affairs in the world beyond it, is a mistake.
Well, that's their problem. They've hit the problem.
Well, I'm suggesting that Bhante is in fact a Madhyamakan at heart, yeah. And therefore, one way to then understand the system, the five orders of conditionality, is as a set of quite serious fictions. Yeah. Let me finish. Which engage with the general tendencies of Western thought, but we needn't necessarily take to be the ultimate truth.
There is an ultimate truth.
Thank you. That was it. Thanks very much.